My husband calls to tell me he forgot something he needs at work this afternoon. He was sure he had left it in his bag. It's a folder containing an important contract. I offer to bring it to him near his office, which will give us an opportunity to eat lunch together. I'm still angry about the Clementine, but I am mature enough to set my anger aside when necessary. Back at home, I spend a long time putting together an outfit for the occasion, hesitating in front of the closet. I have an enormous amount of clothing. I don't buy a lot, but I keep everything. I am incapable of culling, donating, or throwing away. Each piece of fabric is the relic of a bygone era, each article of clothing the memory of a former me, each closet shelf a time machine. I bought this floral mini dress the summer when I was 20. Adrien ripped it off of me before we made love all day long in his dorm room, and I left with my cheeks red and my hair tangled. This pair of jeans brings me back to when I was running around in sneakers, impatient to catch the 47 bus because I was late for a meeting with my research director to talk about my thesis. I bought this bag when I started going out with the man who would become my husband. It was the first luxury handbag I bought for myself, an investment for the future, with money from my first two teaching paychecks. Whether we were going to a movie theater to see an art house film or on our way to eat lunch at his parents' house on Sunday, this bag gave me new confidence. And then there's the maternity dress with the cherry print. I picture myself pregnant and ready to burst, walking slowly and distractedly under the sun, all my time to myself and a chocolate eclair in my hand. My obsession with eclairs was so intense during my first pregnancy that I haven't been able to eat them again since. I change my blouse, swap my jeans for a skirt. In the end, I opt for a dress. I reapply my perfume, hoping that it will finally unleash its danger, but it smells only of flowers and cleanliness. I continue to perfume myself, spray after spray, once, twice, 10 times. But no poison, no passion emerges from the overpriced flask. I can hardly breathe. The sticky, heady rose scent is all over my body. I should shower. I smash the flask against the floor with all my strength. Gathering the pieces of glass, I cut my foot. A drop of blood falls onto the white rug, which I don't try to clean. The red stain pleases me. Finally, a bit of life in this immaculate interior. Before leaving, I blot my silk blouse with ink so I can have an excuse in case my husband asks me why I changed from this morning. I leave the stained blouse out on the bed to perfect my alibi. I'm not sure I'll manage to salvage it, even if I bring it to the dry cleaner tomorrow. It's too bad. That blouse looked good on me. I'm about to apply another layer of mascara when I receive a text from my husband. I know it's him by the personalized ringtone. Of course, I chose something discreet. It's not like La Vie en Rose plays every time my husband messages or calls. I'm not stupid. I chose a ringtone that's available on nearly every phone. 2 very simple notes, a D and a B. No one thinks anything of it, but I know immediately that those are the notes associated with a single contact in my phone, my husband. This trick helps me to avoid a lot of disappointment, hoping it's him only to find that it's just a friend or family member. Is my husband canceling our lunch? Does he no longer need the folder? Did I get dressed and made up for nothing? Is he telling me that he's not coming home tonight? That he's not coming home at all? That he's leaving me? The beginning of the message is displayed on the screen. I can hardly believe my eyes. It begins, "Did you see the latest?" My husband is writing to comment on the latest actions of a politician that I heard something about on the radio earlier. I can't believe it. My husband texts me very rarely. He prefers a quick phone call, like he did earlier, to let me know he's going to get bread or ask me if I can drop off our son at his clarinet lesson. He calls me often, but texts are rare. And today, he's texting to talk politics when we're going to see each other in an hour. It makes no sense. I would have understood if he were writing me to push back our lunch by a half hour. I would have preferred that he be writing to say he loves me and can't wait to see me, or to offer an explanation for why he called me a Clementine. But whatever my husband has to say about this politician, I really couldn't care less. When we'd been going out for a few months, my husband left for a trip to Asia. France's elections were in full swing. I remember one night when he managed to call me from the hotel phone. We didn't have much time, and even so, he decided to bring up the election results. He spoke passionately about the campaign that was nearing its end, the contents of the debates, the person he hoped would become president. I hadn't heard from him in several days. We'd had a hard time connecting by phone, and the lack of news had been excruciating. What did I care whether the left won on Sunday? I hadn't even voted in the primary. I make up a response to feign enthusiasm. I ponder how to conclude my message. I want to write to him, "See you soon, my love. Can't wait." In the end, I settle for, "See you soon." Subdued and detached, exactly how I want him to perceive me. When I arrive, my husband isn't there. I'm early, it's not one yet. But my first thought is that he's not coming. He's left me for good now that he's realized I'm a cold mother and an overly demanding wife. He packed his things in two large suitcases, took the car and rented an apartment downtown whose address he'll refuse to give me. I try to reassure myself by repeating that it's not one yet. The only thing that eases my anxiety is knowing that my husband is punctual. I will know where I stand very soon. I remember the day when we had to sign our homeowner's paperwork just under 10 years ago. We had an appointment with the notary on a Monday at 2:30 during our lunch break. I arrived 15 minutes early. I waited for my husband in front of the entryway, nervously consulting my watch and phone. I tried to call him once at 2:25, a second time at 2:30. He didn't pick up. My husband was never late. Clearly, he had stood me up. He was getting cold feet. He wasn't ready. He had no desire for this life. I decided to ring the intercom at 2:35, tears in my eyes, shaking, prepared to tell our notary that he had to cancel everything. The notary welcomed me with a smile and brought me to his office, where my husband was waiting. He had already begun to initial the copies of the documents while he waited for me. I think of that moment often. I picture my husband leaning over the stack of papers with a pen in his hand. So to calm myself down as I wait, I recall that scene, repeating to myself, he was there all along. People think it's all that anxious waiting that creates dependence and fuels passion. We imagine the object of desire as a man married to someone else, a man who doesn't answer the phone after a certain hour, who's inaccessible on Christmas or during the weeks of summer vacation. Passion is supposed to be born from passively waiting in front of the phone, the jealousy of knowing he's in bed with his wife, not knowing when you'll see each other next. But to the adulterous lovers, to those who love each other from a distance, and to those who are no longer loved, I would like to say that love has never been a question of uncertainty or waiting, that regularity and reciprocity do not alter intensity. I would like to tell them that passion can also grow from domestic stability, from consistently punctual returns home, from the proof of commitment, from the repetition of daily life. I would like to tell them that the heart can also beat at set times. It is exactly 1. I notice my husband's silhouette approaching in the distance. I'm not wearing my glasses. He prefers me without them. But I'm certain that it's him, even from where I am. He must be 20 meters away, maybe 25. Is this the certain proof of love? To be able to distinguish with a glance your beloved silhouette from all other silhouettes, even when you're nearsighted? Is visual hyperacuity a side effect of being in love? From what distance does love begin? When we recognize our beloved from 10, 50, or 100 meters away? My husband suggested that we eat in an Italian restaurant a 15-minute walk from his office. Why go so far? Is he worried a colleague will see the two of us? Is he afraid that someone will ask him about his wife in front of me, bringing his infidelity to light? Is he ashamed of meeting me for a date? It's true that it's not very manly. A business lunch to discuss an important contract with Denmark would better match the image my husband aims to project. We sit on the terrace. I'm reassured. If he didn't want anyone to see us together, he would have chosen a table inside. We've hardly sat down when my husband grabs the folder and slides it into his bag.
It's why you came, after all,
he adds. I don't argue, but it's not true. I'm happy to have come regardless. It's a shame that my husband has to forget an important contract for us to eat lunch together. When the waitress brings us the menu, her youth and beauty rattle me. I don't let it show, and I rationalize, this young woman is very beautiful, but my husband would never leave me for a waitress. There's an English expression for this, wife material. When I met my husband, I knew right away that he would be excellent husband material. He had it all. The right social class, the right degree, a career, elegance. All the qualities of a husband for me and of a father for our future children. Frankly, this voluptuous waitress is not wife material. I don't doubt that she would make for a very good mistress. He could meet her at a hotel sometimes, relish her smooth skin, come between her breasts, but he would never introduce her to his parents. He would never bring her to a dinner with his colleagues, and he would never have a child with her. Basically, this waitress does not pose a serious threat. When she comes back to take our order, I haven't had time yet to look at the menu. My husband knows exactly what he wants. Lasagna. Why doesn't he order meat like he usually does? In 15 years, this is the first time he's ordered lasagna. He also has a question about the dessert and the wine. We just sat down. When did he have the time to think about all this? Did he look at the menu earlier, in preparation for our lunch? Something I often do when I'm meeting him. I feel rushed, so I order the same thing. I don't know what we talk about, but the words flow naturally. Conversation between us has always been fluid. I remember the words that used to pour from his mouth during our first dates. Sometimes we even forgot to make love because we had so much to talk about. Maybe that's why we've always kissed less than other couples. Lovers who kiss all the time often do it to hide their lack of things to talk about. When one's mouth is glued to another's, it's difficult to have a deep discussion on the meaning of life. My husband and I have never felt a need to kiss to fill the void. In any case, that's what I tell myself when Nicolas and Louise kiss in the kitchen during our dinner. They finally have a few moments to speak in private, and instead they prefer to kiss. What a funny idea. Our discussions are dense. Even with the years, they remain rich in vocabulary, references, nuances, metaphors, which is vital. The fear of a lull has always terrorized me. As a teenager, the relationship between Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir was my model. Except for their non-monogamy, open relationships are not my style. I would picture them in cafes, talking for hours and chain-smoking. I would fantasize about a marriage cemented by verbal and intellectual ping-pong, a union in which words played a leading role. With my husband, I always strive to finish his sentences and find new topics of conversation. I'm haunted by the idea that he might start to find me boring. My husband is talking to me. I'm only half listening, but he's talking to me, and that's enough. Hundreds of words, comments, exclamation points thrown into the air. I rehearse my next lines in advance to avoid silence between us at any cost. Our meals arrive just in time. I was struggling to think of what to bring up next. I notice my husband's friendly tone with the waitress when she brings our lunch. What could account for such familiarity? Are they already sleeping together? Is that why he brought me to this restaurant? Does it excite my husband to introduce his wife to his mistress? What a perverse setup. I still don't let anything show on my face. At first, because I don't want to hint at my jealousy. Revealing one's vulnerability is always an error. But also because, from a pragmatic point of view, there is a more important topic that I finally feel able to broach with him. The Clementine. I have to pick my battles. I wait for the right moment in the conversation, then I begin. I've been thinking about what you said last night, about the Clementine. I found it a bit harsh. I, for one, think I'm more of a blackberry or a cherry.
You're still hung up on that?
He responds, laughing. He's laughing it off to shut down the conversation. My husband pauses and takes another sip of wine. Is this his new way of changing the subject? I've lost this battle. We've just finished our meal when a man approaches our table. I recognize him as one of my husband's co-workers. He greets me, asks me how the children are doing. Couldn't he have asked my husband that on Monday morning by the coffee machine? Of the two of us, why is it always me who's asked about our home life and vacation plans? I am disturbed by this man who's with my husband every day at work. He knows my husband as a supervisor, mentor, and collaborator. It's an aspect of his personality that I never have access to myself. Is my husband appreciated, admired, or feared? I wonder what he's like in a professional context, what energy he gives off outside the house, with no wife or children around. I wonder what he's like when I'm not there to see him. My husband invites him to join us for dessert. I pray that he doesn't spoil our date. He must hear my prayers because he declines politely. Before leaving, he calls my husband by the name Arlequin. He understands by my startled gaze that I'm not in on the joke and explains that my husband's team gave him that nickname when they found out he was the one eating all the little colorful candies left out in their common kitchen. Of all the sweets, fruit, and drinks that the company provides for its employees, my husband always chooses those candies. This anecdote, seemingly benign, throws me for a loop. I was not aware of his sweet tooth. My husband has always preferred savory food. When the check comes, my husband pays the bill. It's a minor detail, perhaps, but this small act of care transforms our lunch into a gallant rendezvous. Then I notice that he leaves a frankly excessive tip. The slightly too familiar tone with the waitress, the lasagna, the large tip. Has my husband fallen in love with another woman? Since it can't be the waitress, who is certainly not wife material, who is this other rival that I have to fear? Is it the euphoria of budding love that's making him spend carelessly and change his habits? There are, of course, other possible explanations for the shifts I've noticed in his behavior. Maybe he's just happy to be eating lunch with me, the best case scenario. Relieved to have his file, probably true. Or pleased by the mild weather this afternoon. It is nice out. But something has changed. I can usually predict the meal my husband will order, everything but lasagna, the tip he'll leave on the table, and the way he'll thank the waitress on the way out. I know by heart the way he speaks. I know his tone, his intonations, his syntax. I can anticipate his words. I've even anticipated his sneezes. I know that he doesn't often eat sweet things. So how is it that he has so abruptly become a stranger to me? On the way home, I cry. I cry about the Clementine. I cry about the lasagna. I cry about all the ways my husband has hurt me. I cry and the passers-by stare at me. You don't often see such a beautiful woman crying. I cry, and the worst part is that I'm sure the tears suit me. I'm sure I look like a Racinian heroine. I think often of Phaedra, my favorite lover in literature, and there are plenty. The competition is fierce. I reread that particular Racine play often. The plot revolves around a single narrative axis. Phaedra is madly in love with Hippolytus, but not only is Hippolytus her son-in-law, he loves another woman, Aricia. He resists Phaedra's love, his heart doubly unattainable. Therefore, the situation in which Phaedra finds herself is simple, and her sadness easy to understand. It is the universally recognizable sadness of impossible love. The circumstances are sad, but I have never found them tragic. Phaedra knows the reason for her sadness, Her love is forbidden and incestuous as well as unrequited. Hippolytus is her son-in-law and he loves another woman. Phaedra must resign herself, die, forget, or live with it. She understands her situation. It's a clear predicament, easy to understand, and she can confide in her nurse Oenone and lament her pain in peace. If I could speak to Phaedra, I would tell her that it is even more painful to love someone you already have. Unlike her, I have no real reason to cry. If I had to explain to a passerby why I'm crying, what could I possibly tell them? That I'm devastated because my husband thinks I'm a clementine? That I'm falling to pieces because he ordered lasagna? That I'm in tears because he left a substantial tip? Deep down, I know my tears have no reason to exist. Phaedra's tears are limpid as crystal. Mine are monstrous. Despite our differences, Phaedra and I have at least one thing in common, our rejection of love. Both of us would have preferred not to love. We suffer the consequences of an overly intense and inappropriate love. We feel no complacency about being a woman in love, no satisfaction with ourselves for experiencing such passion. I can't make allowances for my behavior when I work myself up into such a state. I love, but don't think at the moment of loving you, I find myself innocent in my own eyes, or approve.